Good evening. You're listening to the Parliament of Rooks podcast, episode 49. D is for lots of things. Podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Lanise.
And this is his wife, Melanie Lanise.
So as we mentioned last week, we are resuming this episode, one of the cliffhangers that we had left a while back. Way back in episode 43, you know, we had left the framework, you know, of volume two, the dead man story. Hmm. And when last we had left, you know, Boston Brand and his extended cast of characters, we had our tragedy in our little circus family, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tiny was in a really bad spot.
Really bad spot. He was, as a matter of fact, at the end of that story, he was actually dead as far as we knew. But, you know, as we'd seen in the Legion episode last time around, there was a little ad saying that Tiny is actually alive. Mm-hmm. So that is the story we're going to be taking a look at tonight from Adventure Comics number 213, which I think I'd said a while ago, you know, as far as Dead Man goes, you know, at least for this initial arc, there's actually not that many stories. There's only 12 in Strange Adventures, and then there's like two supplementary stories that we're going to be taking a look at in Brave and the Bold, sort of team up with Batman. So out of those 14, tonight's story is actually number 9.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We are so close actually to, you know, both wrapping up this story and to be honest, wrapping up this volume, like next episode is going to be episode 50.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
It's insane, right? Like, you know, like when we first started this, you know, I had no idea, you know, like whether it was going to be a success or not. And next episode, you know, big anniversary.
The big 5-0.
Exactly. So with that in mind, you know, I thought because we're sort of like on the downward slope, I guess, if you want to say, of volume two, it might be time, at least initially, I think, to kind of like, you know, taking a look back at what we've done thus far and kind of figuring out, you know, what the overall themes are going to be, you know, of volume two. A big thing that, you know, jumps into, you know, my mind with, you know, a lot of the stories we did, which honestly, I didn't even anticipate we were going to do. But, you know, as it started taking shape, you know, so much of the stuff we did, whether it was, you know, the Legion or Hawk and Dove or, you know, Swing a Scooter, was all kind of centered around what?
Teenagers.
The teen thing, right? Like, as I say, you know, because I knew Dead Man was going to be the framework. Why would I think teenager? But absolutely, all of the concurrent stuff ongoing was that. And to a certain extent, I think that kind of was a reflection of, you know, what was going on inside DC. Because, you know, as we've talked about, you know, ad nauseum with the whole, like, artistic purge or whatever, they were really trying to go for a younger audience, kind of, you know, like, out with the old, in with the new type stuff.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, we've seen that, you know, a couple different ways, you know, the advent of, like, realism in art, you know, certainly, you know,
more dynamic.
Yeah, with Neil Adams and stuff like that, you know, the experimental panel designs or whatever, they were trying to catch some of that, you know, Marvel juice that was going on. But more so than Marvel, actually, you know, a big company that we have talked about where a lot of this, like, newer talent, you know, to replace a lot of the, you know, the old school DC cats was Charlton Comics. Like, we had definitely seen, you know, certainly Steve Ditko, you know, late of Marvel Comics or whatever, but by way of Charlton, had just come over with, you know, Hawk and Dove and Creeper. But also, you know, the writer of that story, Steve Skeets, a guy we haven't met yet, Jim Aparo. And then the editor, you know, who we keep seeing that little, like, headshot of in all his magazines, Dick Giordano, all these guys were Charlton, you know. And so I thought, you know, that the time might be right, you know, considering we're looking at another Dead Man story edited by Dick Giordano, to just basically, you know, do a little overview of, you know, what Charlton was.
Sounds good.
All right. So so Charlton Comics was one of many, many, you know, kind of small publishing houses, you know, back in the golden age, you know, when DC and, you know, Timely and Fawcett or whatever were kind of like dominated the market. There were like tons of copycat publishers out there who maybe lasted like a year or two, you know, tried to, you know, latch on to, you know, the zeitgeist of, you know, publishing, you know, comic books or whatever. They saw it was a popular thing and kind of wanted a piece of that pie. Charlton Comics kind of came from a different route. Years later, there is a writer by the name of Tony Isabella who basically summed up Charlton Comics in a very sort of pithy quote. He referred to Charlton Comics as, quote-unquote, the low-rent district of the comics industry. Oh. it actually didn't start as a comics company. It was formed back in 1923 by an Italian immigrant, a guy by the name of Gianni Sant'Angelo. He started as a bricklayer, basically, you know, sort of immigrant, you know, masonry-type guy. Mm-hmm. But while he was doing this, in 1934, he hit upon, you know, what he thought was a novel idea. He came up with this idea of printing and selling lyrics to popular songs of the day. You know, basically, you'd hear something on the radio, you know, oh, what was that, or whatever. He's like, what if I, you know, captured all this, you know, published it out, and sold it for a profit? Which he did, and in very short order, you know, it turned out to be a lucrative business for him. You know, he made hundreds of dollars, you know, in supplemental income. Just one problem. It's kind of against the law, you know, this little thing called, you know, copyright law. And
did
so,
he get caught?
Yeah, he did. In very short order, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Producers sued him. And he wound up going to court and getting convicted of copyright infringement and actually wound up spending a year in jail in New Haven, Connecticut.
Hmm.
But it was while he was in jail that actually he met another individual that would, you know, the partnership with whom would basically determine the rest of the course of their lives, you know, and, you know, result in the formation of Charlton Comics. He meets this guy basically in his cell, another, you know, little white collar criminal, former attorney by the name of Edward Levy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he told his idea. He's like, you know, that is a good idea. You just, you know, you kind of went about it a little bit the wrong way. So when they both get out of jail, they actually partner up and they decide to, you know, legally publish these song lyrics. They they form a little company, and turns out, a little bit of a coincidence, each one of them had a son named Charles. So they decided, we're going to call ourselves Charlton, you know, kind of based on that. Yeah. So they started in 1935, like I say, right, you know, as soon as they got out of jail, with their first magazine called Hit Parader, which wound up being very, very popular. It was published probably for, let's say, 50 years, I think. Yeah.
You've
heard of it? Yeah. We probably see a lot of them when we go to the antique shops or whatever, still out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, but one of the things that they kind of ran up against is, you know, the fact that they actually owned, you know, all of their printing equipment. Like, the two of them actually wound up buying, like, you know, a printing press and, you know, the whole nine yards. Basically, they had a publishing company and owned their own presses. So, you know, in between, you know, printing these publications that they're selling, these presses are sitting idle. Now, I don't know if you know anything about, you know, the publishing industry, like, you know, R.R. Donnelly or something like that, but you cannot let presses sit idle. Like, that, every time you shut that off, that's money out the window. You know, you're paying for the space, you're paying for the equipment or whatever. So in order to basically keep their presses running nonstop, they're like, we need to start publishing other things. And right about this time, you know, one of the things that was becoming immensely popular, as we just said, was comic books.
Right.
They're like, you know what? Let's get a piece of this pie, you know, ourselves. You know, it can't be that hard. You know, these are basically made for children. So in 1944, I guess they dipped their toe into the comic book industry with their first superhero publication called Yellow Jacket Comics. No relation to Insect Queen.
No.
From there, you know, as a lot of these publishers did, they diversified into, you know, all the popular genres of the day. You know, they had funny animal comics, Western, romance, just everything, you know, you could imagine that was selling. But unfortunately, you know, for any comic collectors out there that are looking to say, oh, I'd like to, you know, find some of these old Charlton comics, if you ever try to, you know, track any of this stuff down, it's actually like a collector's nightmare. Well, the reason being is that during World War II, if you weren't one of the, you know, big publishing houses, one of the things going on in World War II was rationing. Right. You know, things that, you know, like fuel or like, you know, I don't know.
Paper.
Well, exactly. Well, that's what I was getting to. I was going to say, you know, staple type goods, but certainly paper. All that stuff was rationed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were, you know, a minor publishing company, you know, you didn't have access to, you know, a continual amount of paper to turn all these things out. The way they got around this, obviously, you know, two ex-cons or whatever, they had this little scheme. They're like, well, what if we're not just a publishing company? what if we're multiple publishing companies? So,
okay.
So they registered all these different, like, you know, legal names or whatever, and then would use their own presses to say, hey, these comics are put out by, like, you know, Frank Cominale Publishing Company or Children's Comics Publishers. I'm going down a list of the names: Special Action Comics, Law and Order Magazines, Outstanding Comics, Capital Stories, and then even some of their comics put out under Song Hits Incorporated.
Oh, so they didn't give that up.
Right. Well, no, I mean, so that was their main business, but what I'm saying is they were publishing comics under the aegis of, you know, their uh-huh. yeah, it's so funny. But eventually it begins, you know, coalescing, you know, becoming Charles Publishing Company, and then eventually, as I say, you know, Charlton. So that keeps up basically for about 10 years or so, is the, you know, the 1940s becomes the 1950s. And then, as you and I talked about, you know, comic books in general kind of went into an overall slump. You know, people returning, you know, from the war or whatever, you know, obviously, you know, comics weren't being, you know, supplied to the U.S. Army anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Little kids, you know, kind of got caught up in that whole, you know, aftermath of, you know, the Senate hearings on juvenile delinquency, you know, so their parents were like, oh, you're not going to read comics anymore. They're corrupting right. your mind. So little by little, a lot of these, you know, smaller houses starting getting, like, shut down. And the misfortune, you know, of a lot of these other companies wound up being actually a boon for Charlton. Because, as I say, they, you know, owning all their own printing press or whatever, mm-hmm. were able to weather that storm. And what's more, were able to buy for, like, you know, pennies on the dollar, a lot of the, you know, intellectual property rights from all of these other companies that were closing down.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, big time. Like Fawcett Publications, who owned, like, Captain Marvel, Superior Comics, Simon and Kirby's own, you know, house called Crestwood. But probably the biggest, you know, acquisition that they got, you know, and probably the most fondly remembered, too, when people think about Charlton, they think about this hero, a fellow by the name of the Blue Beetle that they were able to pick up from Fox Feature Syndicate. Not the Fox we know, but the publishing company from the 1940s.
Okay.
The Blue Beetle, as we will soon see as we go into this next section or whatever, is basically the cornerstone of what would become the Charlton action hero line. You know, based upon the success that DC was having, you know, revitalizing a lot of their Golden Age characters, you know, into their sort of Silver Age revivals,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the advent of the new Flash, the new Green Lantern, so on and so forth. Charlton's like, you know what, we can, you know, kind of expand this out a little bit. In 1960, they introduced their first, you know, sort of like original superhero, you know, of this wave, a guy by the name of Captain Atom. But the superhero line doesn't really take off until the advent of a new editor-in-chief in 1965, a fellow by the name of Dick Giordano.
Oh.
Yep, exactly. So that then is going to act as a segue into our next section, where we explore a little bit of the background of Mr. Giordano himself.
Cool.
So Dick Giordano is actually going to become very, very important in the history of DC Comics, you know, as we go forward. He has a long career as both an editor and an inker for DC Comics. And, you know, I think there's actually a gap in his career. You know, for a while, he and Neil Adams go off and form their own studio. But eventually, back in the 80s, a woman by the name of Jeanette Kahn comes in as publisher. And she basically installed her own staff, one of whom was Dick Giordano. And during that period, he becomes, like, really a sort of high-level executive. They kick him upstairs. I think he's the executive vice president. And all throughout my childhood, you know, I would remember him basically as the voice of DC Comics. Like, you know how I said that at Marvel Comics they had a column called the Marvel Bullpen, where Stan Lee would mm-hmm. basically talk about the ongoing, you know, shenanigans at Marvel Comics?
Yeah.
So Dick Giordano, like I say, in the 80s, ran a similar column called Meanwhile. Like, yeah, very, very, like, evocative words that just captures, you know, like an overall atmosphere, you mm-hmm. know, for or comics or whatever. So Meanwhile was a fondly remembered column, and Dick Giordano, a fondly remembered, you know, contributor to DC Comics. But all that, you know, is in the future. For our purposes right now, we're going to turn back the hands of time to the very beginning, to Mr. Giordano's birth in July 20th, 1932. Born, can you imagine where?
New York.
New York City, exactly. And similar to, you know, some stories that we've heard before, specifically Arnold Drake and Jim Shooter, Dick Giordano's introduction to comic books was basically during a childhood illness. I have a feeling that like a lot of kids were sick back in the day, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Like long-term stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So Dick says, you know, in order to like entertain him, you know, his mother and father made sure that he always had plenty of reading material, some of which was actually comic books. And looking at an interview here from Dick Giordano from Comic Book Artist, issue number one, one of the first comic books that he got was actually the first comic book. Something by the name of Famous Funnies. I wonder if he held on to that with a pretty penny. But he says that right off the get-go, he was just mesmerized by, you know, the art and, you know, and he started drawing, you know, at a really early age. He too, similar to a lot of the creators that we've looked at, went to the High School of Industrial Art. I remember, you know, Carmen Infantino went there. I think Gil Kane. Mm-hmm. I know Sikowski went there. But he said that, you know, during his time there, they actually tried to talk him out of going into comic books. They were saying it wasn't a viable field. So at the time...
But it is.
Well, I guess, so certainly for him it turned out to be. But at the time, I guess he majored in illustration and advertising art and put together his portfolio. So he got out of school in 1951 and, you know, started shopping around for a job. And strictly by coincidence, the first art studio he walked into had actually been rented by a comic book writer.
Hmm. Coincidence?
Yeah. So this dude gives him a recommendation, and he hooks him up with an interview with a guy by the name of Jerry Iger, who we may have mentioned a time or two. He was actually partnered for a time with Will Eisner, the Iger and Eisner shop back in the 30s. You know, it employed like a lot of artists or whatever. But Dick Giordano, you know, I guess impresses Iger. He gets a job there, works, I guess, the article says, steady for about 9 months, and then did some freelance. He says initially he was just doing grunt work, like, you know, doing like paid, you know, erasing pages, you know, like if people messed up their pencils or whatever.
Oh, wow.
And he said, but by the time he left, he had begun inking, which Dick Giordano as an artist is, I think, primarily known as an inker.
Okay.
Yeah. So he gets his first big break with Charlton Comics. Actually, his father happened to know a dude who worked there who was an editor by the name of Al Fago. Dick goes up and, you know, shows him his little portfolio, and they like it, you know, immediately. He leaves the Iger shop and goes to work for Fago. And he said this is really where he began to learn his craft. You know, he said that he would get a script every week to pencil and ink. And above all, you know, the thing that he really loved about it is there was no interference whatsoever. They kind of just left him to his own devices. Mm-hmm. Going back to that interview with him, as I say, from a comic book artist, he says that there was a great variety of subject matter to work on. Space adventures, westerns, hot rods, romance. I don't know, hot rods. I didn't know they did comics about cars.
Me either.
But mostly crime. I did those for a couple years. And then in 1955, Charlton decided they wanted to save money by having their artists on staff. They invited a bunch of people up there, which Charlton was actually based out of Connecticut, I think we mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, and myself included, and offered us a position to work on their premises on a piecework basis. This was offered when work was really hard to come by, and essentially the choice was for me to either take this and make less money traveling back and forth every day or find something else to do. So I decided to move up, basically, mm-hmm. you know, cementing, you know, his career path, you know, in the comics industry. So he goes up in 1957 and initially takes a job, I guess, as assistant to the managing editor of Charlton, a guy by the name of Pat Mazzulli. And he does this for about a year or so. And he said initially the work really didn't thrill him. He said that he's always had a problem with staff jobs where you got to work with somebody whose style of dealing with people is different from your own. He said it kind of made him uncomfortable, which... I don't know that necessarily we're going to get into in this episode, but that actually winds up being a sticking point between him and Carmine Infantino.
Mm.
Like the two of them have a completely like, you know, polar opposite, you know, approach
way
to
dealing
with folks. Exactly. So he goes up and, like I say, you know, does the assistant editing, you know, for a while. But in the meantime, you know, also begins freelancing, you know, art wise for a couple of different companies, Dell, Timely, which I think we've mentioned before, is the sort of prototypical Marvel, you know, before they actually became Marvel,
mm-hmm.
you know. And during that time, he meets an individual whose path he'll cross a couple times, that being Mr. Steve Ditko.
Never heard of him.
the two of them, I guess, during this sort of, Marvel transitionary time, do a couple kind of like almost anthology type things like we would have seen from like, House of Secrets or House of Mystery or whatever, kind of like little 8-pagers.
Mm-hmm.
So this continues for a time. And I guess Dick is just kind of chomping at the bit. He feels like, this is good. This is where he wants his career to go. But, he thinks he's like capable of a lot more. So little by little, he starts ingraining himself, in the day-to-day workings of Charlton, trying to learn different things, and all the time, vying for a larger position. And that eventually pays off in the early 60s when they kick him upstairs and let him become an editor for, get this, 17 different titles.
Wow.
Exactly. So going back now to this interview, comic book artist was asking him how he handled that, and basically said one person can't edit 17 books a month.
Not effectively.
Yeah, even if you spend full time at it. Most of the books I had were just traffic managed. I signed the scripts, took the scripts, gave it to an artist, took the art, and sent it down to the engraver. I never read it, never looked at it. I had no idea.
Wow.
The only books I edited at all were the Action Hero lines with Captain Atom, Blue Beetle, The Question, etc., which... I think I've mentioned this to you before, but I think now is the perfect time to, reiterate what the Charlton heroes would eventually become. So Charlton, at a time, and we'll go into this, much, much later, winds up closing down, and DC Comics, also in the acquisition business, basically buys out, all of the superheroes from Charlton.
Mm.
They bring it over, and Alan Moore, who was working there at the time, said, I'd like to do a series with all these. And they're like, we kind of have plans of our own or whatever, but why don't you use basically the ideas of these heroes and make your own thing? So these characters, I say, like Captain Atom, Blue Beetle, Question, these are the templates for Watchmen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Captain Atom is, Dr. Manhattan, the big blue guy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Beetle is kind of, Night Owl, because he's got the big ship or whatever. And the Question, by way of Mr. A, is Rorschach, the Steve Ditko creation.
Oh.
Yeah, it's very, very funny. But back to Dick Giordano, he said, he's like, at Charlton, I don't think anybody really cared. I don't think they put any effort whatsoever into the Action Hero line. And that's why it sold so badly. They didn't do any real promotion or go out and try to beat the brush to try to get people to recognize that Charlton was doing something that was in line with what the big two were doing. We were always badly distributed, and there was no store where you could be sure you were getting all 34 titles.
Hmm.
When I got started at Charlton, no comic readers even knew about Charlton comics unless they were already buying them, because you wouldn't know whether they were going to be there or not in the stores.
Wow, yeah. That's not good.
No, not at all. So Dick goes on, saying that, during his time at Charlton, in addition to doing all the... editing. He tried to really, really learn as much of the, production side of the house as he could, because everything was in-house in Charlton. He had direct access to, the plates and so on and so forth. And so, he goes on in this interview saying that the work had to be engraved, color separated, and printed. The job had to move from department to department, so I spent half my time in the plant and half my time in the editorial offices. The upside is that I learned everything I possibly could learn about the reproduction process, so that when I went to DC, I knew exactly what I was talking about. I already knew how color separations happened, how plates were made, how material reacted on the press, and what you could and couldn't do.
Hmm, which, that's good.
Yeah, it's very, very good. But during this time, as I say, as Dick is learning all the ins and outs of production, Charlton, on the other hand, could care less. They're basically just this, all this, comic production is basically just filler, for their main cash cow. So Dick kind of saw the writing on the wall. He said, Charlton was already looking to cancel out the superhero line. And, he's like, what am I going to do? And it was just around this time that, Steve Ditko, who had been working at Charlton, like I say, he was the artistic creator, I believe, of Captain Atom, and then, of course, later the Question, had begun, making some overtures to DC. They were DC at the time, obviously, in the form of Carmine Infantino, was courting new talent, and Ditko was in the initial discussions for them for the creation of the Creeper and Hawk and Dove, and it was around that time that Ditko himself reached out to Dick Giordano. Going back to the interview, he says that Steve Ditko came up and told me that the people at DC were interested in talking to me about taking an editorial position. He, being Steve Ditko, was really the catalyst for that move. I then went to talk to Carmine Infantino, but I was hired by Donenfeld, being Irwin Donenfeld, not by Carmine. Carmine wasn't in charge of the operation, just the art director at that point. It seems that they found me through Sheldon Mayer, remember, from Sugar and Spike?
Yeah.
See, our show ties it all together. They said that Shelley, being Mayer, you know, was on staff at DC at that time. And they were looking for new editors because they'd been comfortably sitting on their oars while Marvel sailed right past them as the industry leader. So DC was looking for ways to get back into the business. They asked Sheldon Mayer to check around and see if he could find anyone, and evidently he bird-dogged me for one of their editors. And that also included Joe Orlando, who got there about 2 weeks before I did. Hmm. You know, obviously from Mad Magazine, probably by way of, you know, E. Nelson Bridwell, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Ditko calls, you know, Giordano and says, if you're interested, the people at DC would like to talk to you about a position. So I called up and went up and saw Carmen after hours in the office. I didn't realize until later, but they were trying for me not to be seen by the very people I was going to replace. Mm. Carmine and Irwin, Dick says, had come to certain conclusions about certain people that they had on staff who could make the transition into this brave new world they were envisioning and who couldn't. At that point, Marvel was being distributed by DC. Oh, I didn't know that. And was just restricted to 8 books a month. So we got called in with the big idea being to get back our leadership in the industry. Carmine was thought to be one of the few old line artists who could make that transition. He was always an experimenter and always did interesting stuff. He was kind of a Jack Kirby in a lot of ways, but unsung, as most people didn't realize how good Carmine was at what he did. Our mandate, though, was to create new superheroes and a line of books that would challenge Marvel's newfound supremacy. We may not have yet. So in any case, the interviewer asks, you know, that I guess I had interviewed Carmine Infantino earlier, and Carmine said that Dick Giordano was part of a package deal, getting better talent away from Charlton into DC. And that would have included, as I say, you know, Jim Aparo and Skeets and, you know, Denny O'Neill. But Dick says, no, there was no official package deal, no matter what Carmine says. During the early course of our discussions, nothing was mentioned except my coming to work. Later on, into the fourth or fifth meeting, I said, I'd like to bring some of my people with me, and Erwin Donenfeld said, oh, we'd rather expect that. It was very common then that when an editor moves, he takes some of his creators with him. It wasn't like, you know, either these people are coming with me or I'm not taking the job. He's like, I'd already been given the job and accepted the terms. And so I guess, you know, me and Carmen disagree on that. So at that point, they tell him what books he's getting, and they give him 8 titles, you know, kind of a step down from 17. Right. And so what's he get? He gets Young Love, Secret Heart, so a couple of the romance titles, I guess, from Jack Miller. Secret Six, which is the, you know, E. Nelson Bridwell thing. Creeper, Hawk and Dove, you know, because, you know, he had known Steve Ditko, so he'd work well there. Bomba and Aquaman. Oh, they don't mention Strange Adventures, though. That's interesting.
But they did mention Aquaman.
Well, that's true, yeah. And honestly, Dick Giordano's Aquaman with Steve Skeets and Jim Aparo, I don't know necessarily that we're going to read any of that, but maybe we'll read it offline because it's really, really good stuff. So let's see. They tell him that Bomba and Blackhawk are dead. They're canceling it. He's just doing a wrap-up for that. But ironically, he says that he really enjoyed doing the romance books.
Well, imagine it was easier.
But, you know, more so than easy, he said he was allowed to design whatever he wanted, and that became, you know, the love of his life.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And said when he first got Young Love to edit, he went to Jack Miller. But the people there said, just ignore him, because obviously, you know, Jack Miller...
Oh, on his way out.
On his way out, exactly. So the interviewer says, your arrival at DC was ballyhooed. And Dick's like, yeah, Joe Orlando made that little pencil drawing of me saying, hi, I'm Dick. You know, that we've seen it a couple of... Yeah, so, and he's like, and I inked it. He's like, I wrote that copy and I touted my own arrival. And the interview says, time of your arrival, the DC books really started to open up graphically. And Dick replies, yeah, you know, somewhere along the line, you're going to find that 2-page spreads on the second and third page really become the norm. Joe Kubert, who is a war artist... And Joe Orlando.
I remember his name.
Yeah, yeah. So he started it, and then Joe Orlando, you know, picked it up. And I used the device occasionally. We did it because in the production department said it couldn't be done. Remember I said I worked in production at Charlton? Well, I went into DC production department and said, yeah, it can be done, and I'll show you how. And that's when we started with the 2-page spreads. Production was in control of the artwork. The editors at DC were held captive by the production department because the editors that were there before us, like Schwartz and Miller and Boltonoff and Weisinger and Kaniger, they didn't know anything about artwork. Production would just hand out the inking assignments. Joe Orlando came up with the idea of a 2-page spread in a romance story that I inked, and they told him, you can't do that, it won't match up. And I said, why won't it match up? And they said they couldn't guarantee it, and I said, BS, just send it through, it'll match up. The only thing you can't do to this day is have lettering in the center because the words might go into the spine, you know, kind of where it creases.
Yeah,
yeah. So they said, oh, Joe Orlando, did the two of you get along? Dick says, initially, Joe Orlando and I bonded because we were the two new kids on the block. And at that point, we were the only artists that were editors. So basically, we were standing back to back, protecting each other. It was made clear that we were the new important kids on the block. The other editors either treated us with respect or at arm's length. It's kind of a strange situation. DC was always a very businesslike place. Arnold Drake would come in with his hat, his tie, and his jacket, and Joe and I were there essentially to loosen things up. Not that I didn't wear a tie and a jacket, and I did until I retired in 1993, but I haven't worn a tie since. Did you hit it off with Neil Adams? Neil Adams and I were the quote-unquote young Turks there. We bonded immediately, and we decided to make things happen. Neil got to DC before me, so he was already hounding the production department. He used to go in there and give him a hard time every day to get better color work and good cover separations. I got to the point that Jack Adler liked so much what Neil was doing that he couldn't make a move without discussing it first with Neil. Jack was in charge of color, and Neil was doing everything he could to keep him challenged. So the interviewer asks Dick, you know, in wrapping up, what was your editorial style? And Dick says, I knew what I wanted to do, and I picked the people who knew how to do that. So I didn't have to get too involved with the creative process. You can't. An editor can't control the creative process without affecting the work in a negative way. You can't get into the faces of the people while they're doing creative work. You can advise them before they start. You can give helpful tips along the way, but you can't control the creative process without hurting it.
That flies in the face of Mort Weisinger.
Mort Weisinger, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, in conclusion, you know, they ask him, you know, point blank, why did you want to work in comics? And Dick says, I wanted to be in comics. So did Neil Adams, so did Joe Kubert, so did Gil Kane. It's not that we didn't want to do anything else. All of us have experimented here and there. It's just that comics offered more of what we wanted to do. And so,
and I think that's important, you know, like following like what it is that you want to do. And he really did. I mean, as a kid, he was just like, you know, immediately drawn toward it.
Yeah, like even to say, like when he was 5 years old, like a little, you know, sick kid reading comics, he's like, oh, I want to start drawing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And he did, and then went to school for it. But I think it's interesting that they tried to talk him out of it in school.
And then he kept getting drawn back to it, and nevertheless.
Yeah, and then like, the first place he rents, you know, is comics.
His comic books. Yeah.
But, you know, by contrast, Jim Shooter, you know, was like, I guess, like, you know, really passionate, like, as a young boy, what was it, 14 years old?
Yeah, with his writing or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and, like, sending in his stories. But then he went to college and tried to get away from it.
Tried to get away from it. Yeah, well, I mean, so Shooter's kind of a different situation, as we talked about last week or whatever. He was kind of doing this as an option that he saw available to him, you know, basically to help his family. Whereas Dick, I think, you know, was passionate about it from the get-go, you know, so... but like I say, you know, different styles or whatever. Certainly, you know, each is going to have, you know, as we mentioned, very, very storied careers. You know, I think, you know, Jim initially with a revisitation to DC, but then eventually, you know, much larger scale on the Marvel side, you know, whereas Dick Giordano, I think, you know, is going to follow a very similar path, you know, on DC. But as I say, you know, all of that is, way, way in the future. For tonight, you know, we're still looking at the very beginnings of Dick's DC career. You know, we've seen a couple issues here and there. You know, he did the Hawk and the Dove and Showcase. Mm-hmm. And then I mentioned, you know, he had already taken over the editorial chores on Strange Adventures.
Mm-hmm.
But I think was doing some cleanup work. This might be his first comic where his actual editorial hand, you know, might be felt in the Dead Man story. And that story, as I say, was from Strange Adventures number 213, the Call from Beyond, from July, August 1968. Cover, as always, you know, triple threat here, Neil Adams, penciled and inked and colored with letters by Gaspar Saladino. The story itself is written by Neil Adams, penciled and inked as well. Colors unknown. Let's just speculate, Neil Adams, why not? and letters by a fellow by the name of Ben Oda. So first things first, let's go ahead and take a look at the cover here, which is a very, very classic shot. We haven't actually seen this yet, but I think as we go through another couple, you know, different comic books in this month, we're going to see this actually as an ad. You know, they take this block of art and overlaid, it, you know, would be the words, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. I think we might see that coming forward. But for now, what we just see, you know, is the art itself, which is the prone body of, you know, circus strongman Tiny, you know, who, as I said, you know, we had thought was dead, but is in a coma as in the background, you know, in a complete, I was going to call it an overlay, but it's more like an underlay, I guess, right?
Yes, yeah.
Is the screaming form of Boston Brand, you know, shouting to the heavens, don't die, Tiny. And so we have Dead Man starring in Strange Adventures.
So that's Dead Man's Classic look, I guess, like the Screaming Profile.
Screaming Profile, which, by the way, I mentioned a couple episodes ago that we had gone to that comic convention to meet Jim Shooter and Neil Adams. A little thing, and you would know if you were a member of the TPOR Facebook page. we got a sketch from Mr. Adams, of Dead Man doing just that, screaming to the heavens. and he, autographed it to the Parliament, so it's going to be a prized possession of
it's super cool.
Lenise household. All right, so we turn this open and begin the call from beyond, lettered by Ben Oda in a very sort of, psychedelic, swirly fashion.
Mm.
And what we see, and we'll see this for the first couple pages, is kind of a divided art. We see, more realistic, grounded type art, on the right side, whereas on the left, we see Boston Brand in some sort of, swirly netherworld, completely awash of color. It's just like, sort of black and white, and then, shaded in various styles by Adams. This first panel, we're going to see him using stippling, but then later, you're going to see hatching and then cross-hatching or whatever, which, once again, for the benefit of everyone listening, I'm reading this from the original book, whereas Melanie's taking a look at it in the Dead Man collection, and peeking over your art, at least the black and white, the grayscale stuff.
It's much more definite.
Really, really. Because obviously, this is printed on newsprint, which I think, couldn't handle the advanced, art techniques that Adams was trying to, maybe Jack Adler had a point with regard to production. But for your benefit, because I know this story or whatever, just a little thing. Anytime you see the realistic thing, this is a flashback.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of swirly psychedelic stuff is actually Boston's present state. So he's here,
okay,
thinking back. So we'll see this in short order. So our narration begins. How mightily you screamed your anguish when you thought Tiny was dead. He'd taken your place to catch your murderer, the hook. But all he caught was a bullet. A bullet meant for you. Is this swirling miasma your punishment for allowing Tiny to be shot in your stead? No? Then could it be you're here as a result of those words spoken moments after Tiny's body was found? Remember, as now, let me see, we go into flashback with the more realistic thing, as we see Boston in the exact same position as he is in the, swirling miasma, saying, "Hey, I feel a heartbeat. Tiny's not dead yet." "Not dead yet," says the narration. "Yes, those words are the ones that brought you here, Dead Man." Bum, bum, bum. We turn our page as, he continues his sort of, otherworldly journey, kind of traveling down this corridor, which, as you'll see in a moment, is kind of evocative almost of a biological system, right? Kind of like riding up, a vein almost. You see sort of like, corpuscle? What's that word? The sort of like, blood cells as, the narration continues. Tear your way through those protective layers of unconsciousness. Hurry, hurry. Faster than that ambulance attendant who took Tiny to the hospital. As, we go to the, right panel and see that flashback. There's Boston over the ambulance. Hurry! Hurry, you fool! Can't you see he's dying? As, indeed, Lorna's like, please, hurry! I'm going as fast as I can, lady, says the ambulance guy. I don't want to kill him before the doctor gets to him. Just real quick, in the background, we see all the sort of, like, circus performers, like Toby the Clown and, some sort of, hand. But there's this, acrobat lady, which because of the way the shading looks like topless or whatever.
Yeah.
But like in yours, obviously, she's wearing some sort of circus leotard thing.
Yeah, mine's much clearer.
So we continue, Boston's little spectral journey. He's peeling through, fibers of matter or whatever. It says, you feel almost physical pain at the pummeling of the half-forgotten memories this alien environment hurls into your path. Still, your job seems hardly as difficult as was the doctor's who worked on Tiny. As, we go on a flashback and see that doctor. He says, nurse, place that clamp and then get a call to Dr. Clate. What a mess. We see him. A nice shot, actually. It's for, almost from the perspective of the body, looking up at the doctors, doing the operation. So the narration continues. You discovered the new doctor was a heart surgeon and not an optimistic one. No more encouraging than these misdirected wisps of imagination which now block your way. As we see, Boston black and white shot, little, I guess, beams trying to prevent him from, getting to his destination.
Mm-hmm.
And go to flashback as, one of the other doctors like, you realize, Dr. Shasti, this man should be dead. True, says Dr. Shasti. His continued survival amazes me, as does your surgical skill, doctor. Nurse Beckman, retractor, let me close this artery off. As you hurl yourself against the fantastic barrier of misdirected imaginings, you recall your futility as Dr. Shasti spoke to the circus people after Tiny's operation. We see these imaginings, almost like little like demony things, you know, attacking dead man. As in the flashback, you know, we see Shasti, you know, briefing the circus folks, saying, "Although your Mr. Tiny is of a great physical constitution, he's in such deep shock that he cannot utilize his will to survive. I'm afraid that it is but a matter of time before we lose him." "You tried, Doc. You tried," says Boston in the background. "But I'm the one that failed Mr. Tiny."
Yeah.
"But I'm the one that failed Tiny. That fatal failure of a dead man. What cruel justice have I become a tool of?" So poetic. As we turn the page and we see, "Don't die, Tiny, don't die!" You know, Boston and now what is clearly, you know, sort of biologic, right? You know, we see almost a brain type shape in the background as, you know, then we see the form of Tiny in this other world sort of like wrapped around, I don't know what you'd call them, you know, some sort of, you know, biologically spectral cage, you know, basically evocative of his coma, let's say.
Mm.
So later, you know, in the real world, we see at Tiny's bedside, your reverie was interrupted. As, you know, Boston's sitting there on the chair next to Tiny's bed as, you know, we hear a voice come in and say, "Sorry, sir, you'll have to leave. No one's allowed in here." "What?" says Boston, spinning around, thinking they're talking to him. But no, it's Vashnu. "I have come for my friend," says Vashnu. "If I stand here in silent meditation, can I harm him, Dr. Shasti?" "No," says Dr. Shasti. "But can you help him?" "You, Vashnu of Cardona." "Since you are not only a countryman of mine," says Vashnu, "but also have heard of me, I wonder that you should ask me that question. You know that Ramakrishna seeks only to balance the good in nature." "And?" says Dr. Shasti. "And perhaps, with the help of Ramakrishna, some friendly spirit will help tip the balance in favor of this harshly dealt with man."
So he does know dead man's there, then?
Well, yeah. So I think kind of Vashnu, we're getting the idea over these past couple of stories, knows more than, you know, what's
then
going on.
Than he's been letting on.
Been letting on, right. "Friendly spirit," thinks Boston. "Say, if I can get into Tiny's," as now that must have been, you know, the moment of departure, you know, that our story is now picking up in. Because indeed, you know, on the next panel, we see him in that netherworld, sort of merging now with the spectral form of Tiny. He's doing his dead man trick, but in the world beyond. As our narration says, "So you've burrowed your way into Tiny's mind and finally located his id, his personality, the part that is the essence of Tiny." As we see Boston merge and saying, "Come on, Tiny, a spark, anything, you gotta fight, for it." As in the real world, we see, you know, Tiny in the hospital bed, you know, with that telltale glow around him, right? Going, "Oh." As Dr. Shasti's like, "By the greatness of Ramakrishna, he's fighting. He's on top of it. I'll check him out, but unless I'm mistaken, he's going to pull through." Why did you say that just because of a groan? So, hours later, says the narration, Tiny is greatly improved as Dr. Shasti is making an urgent phone call. We see, you know, Shasti in his office saying, "He'll recover, and Vashnu, or some ghost, is responsible. That's right, Vashnu is an honored seer in my country. Why he's here, I don't know, but you must meet him." "Now that Tiny's on the road to recovery, dead man," says our narration, "you're about to leave his room and pick up your hunt for the hook, where it left off." But suddenly, you know, we see Shasti, you know, with a tour of doctors saying, "Vashnu has left, but gentlemen, there is the result of his work," as he, you know, points to the, I guess, you know, semi-conscious body of Tiny. "If we could bring Vashnu before the board, I'm sure they'd award us the grant." "Well, your enthusiasm is admirable, Dr. Shasti," says, I guess, hospital administrator. "But $1.5 million grant for psychic research could hardly be given on this kind of evidence." "True," says Dr. Shasti. "It's not an overly dramatic event, but..." The hospital administrator, you know, consoles him. He's like, "Dr. Shasti, please have faith. I'm sure Madame Pegan's demonstration tonight will convince the board of the importance of our research. That and your reputation will make it possible to get the grant." "Of course," says Dr. Shasti. "Of course, gentlemen. Forgive my overenthusiasm." "Madame Pegan?" says the dead man, scratching his head. "What kind of bag you got in yourself, Dr. Shasti? This sounds weird." So as Dr. Shasti's visitors...
Says a dead man.
Yeah. So as everybody leaves, you know, we see this young boy come in, you know, up to Dr. Shasti. "Hi, Dad. I came to walk you home." "Oh, hi, son," says Dr. Shasti. "I hate to disappoint you, but you're going to be late. Research. You understand, son," says the kid sarcastically. "Well, I don't understand. I might as well not have a father, little as I see you." "But the work's important, Sammy." "Sammy, no!" As, you know, his son runs away. And dead man thinks, "This guy's really hung up on this whole ghost hunting bit." So hours later, your curiosity has led you to Madame Pegan's along with Dr. Shasti and the board's directors. We see, you know, the whole crew arriving at this, you know, little brownstone. Come in, gentlemen. Madame Pegan has been preparing herself, says Dr. Shasti. Her powers are at their fullest. Cool, says Dead Man as he, you know, flies through the wall of the building. So we enter, you know, into, you know, the, I guess, epicenter of Madame Pegan's, you know, everything all dimly lit in a sort of, you know, red bulb, 1960s or whatever. Everything has kind of a magenta wash over it.
I gotta tell you, my colors are really garish.
Really garish. Well, yeah, of course. And the computer coloring in the new one, yeah, they have not muted. And you know why, as I'm looking over? Because it's solid block of color. There's no, like, you know, shading or whatever. You know, it's like basically the back of, you know, Dead Man's costume or like that person's face, right? It's just, you know, solid block of red.
Yeah, or this like really stunning shade of hot pink.
Hot pink. So our narration picks up saying, did you ever consider the possibility of other ghosts, Dead Man? Perhaps you're about to meet one or two. There's, you know, we see all these doctors, I guess, gathered around, you know, almost like at a seance table as Madame Pegan begins saying, And actually, you know what, since you have some, I guess, you know, exposure or whatever to, you know, new agey types, I'll let you voice Madame Pegan.
Oh, awesome.
So what does she say?
I merely require silence and a small amount of concentration, gentlemen.
As a Dead Man floats above her saying, I'm all ears, baby. As Madame Pegan, you know, goes into some sort of trance, you know, saying,
hear me, O spirits, send out the call. Let those who care hearken to me. There are those who would speak to you.
Is she Glinda the Good Witch?
She looks like Ursula here.
Or from what, The Little Mermaid?
Yeah. We see you. We hear you through the veil. Come to us. Make your presence known.
As a Dead Man, you know, thinks exactly what I'm thinking about you. she puts on some act. We could have used her at the circus. What? Wait a minute. What's that? Thinks Dead Man as above Madame Pegan, we see some sort of like, you know, yellow spectral cloud begin forming. Holy jumping blue blazes! Where did that come from? As in this cloud, we see the form of, I guess, some sort of like socialite woman, you know, done up in like, you know,
equestrian.
Yeah, herb. Well, good. Obviously, I didn't know the word, but yeah, exactly. Equestrian, like horse riding clothes, and she got a little dog, you know, running around. Diane, says one of the guys at the seance table. Walt, you recognize that? Whatever that is? Says a guy sitting next to him. Recognize her? Says Walt, recognize her? She's my sister. Or at least she was. She and her horse and her dog were killed in an avalanche during a hunting party. Holy cow. Wow. Diane, can you speak to me? Yes, Wally. Can I respect the voice of Diane? Well, if you're going to perform, I will too. I can speak to you for a short time. What would you like to know? Diane, I don't know. I'm at a loss for words. How do you feel? I gotta find out about this, says Dead Man, you know, reaching out to this ghost. I feel fine, Wally. Why shouldn't I? And Dead Man's like, my hand went right through her, like she was a ghost. But I'm a ghost. She doesn't seem affected by my touch. And people, says the narration, live people freeze at your cold touch, don't they, Dead Man? Wally, I guess, continues. He's like, you look great. Is there anything you could tell me about where you are, Diane? Sure, Wally, says the ghost of Diane, but there's something more important I must tell you. There's an evil spirit in this room. It doesn't want me to talk anymore. I'm fighting it, but it's a very strong spirit. As, you know, Dead Man recoils, thinking, this is crazy. I'm beginning to believe this mumbo-jumbo. I see with my own eyes, but no, it's got to be a fake.
It does.
If this were a real person, I'd be able to immobilize her and take over her body. This is too confusing. I gotta put a stop to this so I can collect my thoughts somehow. So we turn our page and... Well, before we do, we get to, in my book at least, a couple pages of advertisement, you know, a direct currents, including a direct currents for the very issue we're reading. Tiny's alive, but his weak group, you know, da-da-da-da. Yeah. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
So we continue on, you know, to the story proper as... Diane! You know, the guy's shouting, can we do anything to help? I don't know, says the ghost of Diane. The spirit is so strong. If you could somehow... I gotta stop this, says Dead Man flying away. I gotta think. What's this guy doing next to the fuse box? As we see a sort of, you know, like a thug-looking dude standing there. As Dead Man leaps right into him and grabs the fuse box, saying, this ought to stop something, as he rips it off the wall and crackles. Eee! Scream. as moments later. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that your line?
Go ahead. I don't know.
Yeah, that's Madame Pegan. You said
really?
It then. Yeah, so he's the fuse box and she says,
yee!
There you go. So moments later, this is narration, one of Madame Pegan's men turns the lights back on as he comforts her. He's like, are you all right, Madame Pegan? You screamed and fainted when the lights went out.
Yes, a bit shaken up, but that's all.
I'd say we're all a bit shaken up, says one of the dudes. This has been a rather unnerving experience. If you don't mind, I think we'd all like to go home and consider the situation.
Of course, gentlemen.
As they all leave and, Dead Man still skulks about, he's like, now, to see if I can dig up something besides ghosts. As he's wandering around, he's like, man, get a load of these doors. As apparently Madame Pegan lives in this big mansion, right? Yeah, the doors are like 20 feet tall, big sort of columns and gargoyles next to them. They gotta be hiding something big, says Dead Man. Fortunately, I don't need a key to find out what. As he starts, poking through the door, and all of a sudden we hear, a loud voice in the background. Hey, you, get your hairy paws off me. I've come to see my father. Huh? Says Dead Man. That sounds like Dr. Shasty's kid. I told you, let me go. As we cut and we see, the guards trying to restrain the kid as he kicks him in the knee. Ow! Sammy, says Dr. Shasty. Son, what are you doing here? I thought you went home. I followed you here. But when the other doctors left and you didn't, I got worried. Are you coming home now? All right, son, says Dr. Shasty. I believe I will come home.
But I thought you'd stay and talk longer about the grant,
says Madame Pegan. As Dr. Shasty's like, I'm afraid what I have to say won't please you, Madame Pegan. But the demonstration tonight convinced me that I'm not equipped to deal with these matters. I'm sorry. I therefore fear I must withdraw my support of this project, at least temporarily. Now that's that, says Dead Man. Now I can get back and take a look at the door again. But as Dead Man goes to look at the door, Madame Pegan, interrupts the doctor's departure, saying,
one moment, doctor. Your support is essential, doctor. We must receive the grant. Now I'm forced to reveal to you something I had hoped I could protect you from. Please, come with me.
Says Madame Pegan as she stands before those grand doors. There's like little torches and stuff. Very sort of atmospheric, right? She's like cast into shadows.
Yeah, she's like looking very like mystic and powerful.
Yeah. So the doors open and Madame Pegan leads this entourage. Dr. Shasty, the little boy, and a couple others, and saying,
this house was built on the very spot on which a door to the spirit world has forever been located. That is why my ability to contact the other world is so easily come by.
As our camera eye draws back and we see the entirety of this room. It's just this, almost like cavernous thing. Why this lady has a house like this, I have no idea. But we see these, mammoth statues of, monsters and such, as the crew, enters into this big hall, Madame Pegan continues saying,
you have never been in this mystic room, Dr. Shasty. It represents our symbolic protection from what next you will see.
As Dead Man just looking at, this thing, floating cross-legged and then says, thinks, bunk. As, Pegan now leads him to the mammoth doors and says,
these are the doors to the spirit world, actual doors of this world that conceal the barrier you must pass through, Dr. Shasty, and pass you must.
Looks like he's going to get inside before I do. All right, Doc, after you. As the doors open and Madame Pegan, gives him a shove from behind. Wait, you can't.
You must learn, Dr. Shasty, you must.
As the door, ka-chungs behind him. And the Dead Man thinks, well, isn't Madame Pegan turning out to be a goody two-shoes of 1968? Dad, says Sammy, right, is his name. I'm afraid. You and me both, son. Let's see what's going on in here. As they go deeper into the room, all of a sudden, the room comes alive with electricity. Crack, crack, crackle. Get back, says Shasty, throwing his son to the floor. This is real enough, says Dead Man. There's enough electricity here to kill anybody who's unfortunate enough to be alive. As we turn our page and hit one of those, beautiful two-page spreads that Dick Giordano is so fond of, It can't be, says Dr. Shasty. I don't believe it. I don't. As we see, very, very nice layout, for the benefit of anyone listening. They're kind of like, as I say, a two-page spread, but only three panels. We have a reaction shot of Dr. Shasty in like a triangular fashion in the upper left corner, but then spreading the page, almost like a banner type panel, and then reflected on the bottom by another triangular panel. So in the banner-ish, panel, we see all of these, H.P. Lovecraftian creatures, you know, coming from the spectral world. Dr. Shasti, man of little faith, how can you deny the spirit world? How can you deny the evidence of your own eyes? How must you be punished for not supporting the cause?
So those are spirits?
Yeah, right. What cause, says Dr. Shasti? What cause are you talking about? Madam Pegan's cause. The cause of putting to rest the souls you see around you. Something's fishy around here, thinks Dead Man. I gotta find out if I can... Aha, he says, turning around. He sees something that sparks his interest. Let's just see if we can't shake the shock out of you, Pop Sammy, says Dead Man, you know, leaping into the little boy. First, we're gonna need that crowbar. Inside Sammy, he picks up a crowbar and, smashes an electrical box. This'll short out those mystic lightning bolts. As now Dead Man as Sammy, so once again, for the convenience, I'm just gonna do the Dead Man voice. Better get back, Pop. There's gonna be fireworks. What are you doing? Says Dr. Shasti. That won't help. But with a great sound and fury, the crowbar descends upon the mystical lightning, causing a very real short circuit. Gzak! Yahoo! That's what I call a freak out, Pop. let's go, Pop. It's time we found out what makes these evil spirits tick. As Dead Man as Sammy goes rushing toward these creatures. No, son, don't go in there. Come back. There's great danger. Dead Man as Sammy's not having it, because he goes right up to the great danger, grabs one of these creatures around the leg and breaks it off, as you see basically a 2x4, yeah. Splitting and the fabric ripping. He's like, great danger from what, Pop? From these rejects from Lost in Space? Look at how flimsy this material is. As he starts hitting the creatures with a crash. Come on, Pop, lend a hand. This is a cool scene. Props, says Dr. Shasti. Paper dummies, movie monsters. What a fool I've been. What a fool. As he picks up, one of the beams and what does it read?
Infantino and Giordano, Movie Prop Company Incorporated.
Infantino and Giordano. Obviously, Neil Adams taking a little dig at it, his editor. Exactly. Save some for me, son. Save some for me, says Dr. Shasti. As now they're going to town, smashing these things. But from behind, Madame Pegan comes in, wielding a gun, saying,
yikes. Sorry, she didn't say that, guys. She's actually saying, that's enough, Dr. Shasti. Your childish display has placed you in grave danger. You realize that you and your son must remain under guard until the board awards us the grant.
But Dr. Shasti, thought better of it. And he's like, because I humbly advise against that course of action. You see, before I became involved in this farce, I had just completed my son's training for black belt in judo, myself being a fourth Dan. Really? Oh, brother, I guess I'm not needed here any longer. But Madame Shasti says,
no mumbo-jumbo double talk about what color belt you're wearing will help, Dr. Shasti. Take them to the basement, boys.
But apparently, Dr. Shasti, wasn't kidding around, because he's like, are you prepared, son? Sure am, Pop, says, young Sammy. As Dead Man thinks, first and fourth black belt? I think I'm going to close my eyes for this one. It's going to be too much violence for a sensitive type like me. But meanwhile, while this is going on, Dead Man, pulls a little trick of his own, because he enters Madame Pegan's body and makes a phone call. Now Madame Pegan as Dead Man, so I'll spare you. You don't think you could do a Dead Man voice?
No, I doubt it.
That's right, Sergeant. There's three men assaulting Dr. Shasti and his son on my premises. It's terrible. That's right. My house is located right next to the old movie warehouse on Front Street. Me? I operate a fraudulent fortune-telling establishment.
Oh.
goodbye, Sergeant. Thank you. We turn the page, the cops showed up and leading this motley crew away. Madame Shasti, her bodyguards, and, oh, look, actually the actress playing the equestrian woman. And the cops are like, man, did you see that closed-circuit TV rig in the living room? What a setup for a con. We see the cop talking to Dr. Shasti saying, you can prefer charges in the morning, Doc. We've been trying to pin something on this group for some time. Would you like a lift home? No, thank you, Sergeant, says Dr. Shasti. My son and I will walk. We have a lot of catching up to do. But as they depart, who's left standing alone? Dead Man, who, once again, his mission revitalized in his mind, thinks, but who can I talk to now that the Hook's trail's gone cold? Count your minutes, Hook. Within one of them, soon, you're going to find a dead man waiting. The end. Boom, boom, boom. Mm. And don't peek on that other page, because that's a preview of the next story. So, we'll flip in the real book, to the letters page, the old Dead Man's Chest, which not too, too much going on here, but just something that caught my eye or whatever, you know, with regard to DC Artistic Crew. We see a letter here by R.L. Thomas, who is not, in fact, Roy Thomas. I looked it up, and Roy Thomas is not L as his middle initial.
Hmm.
It says, Dear Editor, as of this letter, there have been, let me count them, I'm supposed to be a math major, 7 issues of Strange Adventure featuring Deadman, the most unique hero I've ever come across. More important, these 7 appearances of the late Boston Brand have convinced me that Deadman is better than Green Lantern, my previous number one DC publication. Be proud. Realism, he says, is the key here. Having tried writing, I know how hard it is to accurately portray human emotions. Your scriptures have done a marvelous job. And the art, he says, Neil Adams is DC's cleanup hitter in my book.
How about it?
Yeah, when you consider that Infantino, Anderson, Gil Kane, Green, and Bob Kane are on the same team, this is saying something. At least I hope it's saying something. It would be a pretty stupid letter if it weren't. I get a special kick out of those full-page action scenes. That double-page scene in the center of Strange Adventures number 209 was almost suitable for framing, which I happen to know 209, that's the Eagle story, so it was the big scene on top of the Ferris wheel or whatever. Let's see, almost suitable for framing. I hope this turns out to be a trait of Neil Adams in every episode. One more thing. In last issue, 211, I detected the embryonic stages of a letter column. Might I suggest calling it The Medium. A good letter column deserves a good title, and it's the best I can think of. But Dick, you know, says, well, as you can see, we already have a letter title. Thanks anyway. The double page thing will appear regularly, but not in every issue. We don't feel we should force it just for the sake of doing it. But if it works well for that particular issue, we'll do it. By the way, you forgot Joe Kubert and Steve Ditko in your all-star lineup. Or did you? This is Dick. Which, is a funny thing, though, like, when that dude was listing, like, all of his favorite artists or whatever, so he lists Carmen Infantino, Murphy Anderson, Gil Kane, I guess Sid Green, and Bob Kane. But the funny thing is that, A, Carmen Infantino is no longer doing artwork, right? He left the Flash now to become art director, so he's not actually doing, like, drawing anymore. Murphy Anderson, as we mentioned a few episodes ago, left the Spectre because he thought comic books were dying and is now doing artwork for the Army, right, for Preventative Maintenance Monthly. And Bob Kane, you know, the, you know, quote-unquote artist for Batman, has been ghosted for, like, the past 20 years. Like, he hasn't done his own art in forever and a day. So the only guys he's really championing, I guess, are Gil Kane and Sid Green. All right, so that wraps up this issue. But going back to the Deadman collection that you're looking at, there actually is a another little interview that I kind of want to take a look at. It's a joint, you know, behind the scenes interview with Neil Adams and Dick Giordano. So kind of neat, and it's conducted by an artist by the name of Nicola Cuti. And it's a kind of a neat little you know, behind the scenes type thing. So if you don't mind, you want to read a couple little snippets of this?
Yeah.
All right. So, I'll just kind of skip around. So, like, Cootie's asking directly to Adams. First question, was this the first series you did for DC? And Adams is like, no, the first series I did for DC that I penciled was The Spectre. And Dick Giordano jumps in. He's like, that only was 3 issues. And Adams is like, yeah, 3 issues. And everybody on Earth was totally offended that I would dare follow Murphy Anderson and try to equal him or compare myself to him in any way. Giordano's like, in a lot of ways, that was some of the best stuff you ever did. And Adam's like, well, certainly the first issue wasn't very good. Giordano's like, that's the time when you had trouble telling people what to read next. Adams goes, I think that came to a head in Brave and the Bold, Batman versus the Creeper. There were 4 pages I drew which were completely unintelligible to me.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, yeah. I designed 1 page where the panels were in the form of arrows so you'd know where to read next. You know, so,
I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. So, everybody laughs, including you. And then Cootie says, all right, well, getting back to Deadman, even though Arnold Drake and Carmine Infantino created the character, you eventually wound up doing most of the issues. Did you ask him, or did you ask for him, or was he assigned to you, or what? And Adams is like, well, what happened was Carmine and I were working on covers, and Carmine was offered the job of art director. He offered me Deadman because he thought I'd do a decent job. And Dick Giordano jumps in. He's like, with Carmine getting the art director's job, I was brought into the picture by Carmine and offered editorship of Deadman as well as other books. And Adams says, Carmine impressed the executives at Kinney, which we haven't actually talked about that yet. I mentioned that DC was bought out by Kinney.
Right.
But yeah, at some point we're actually probably going to have to talk about, you know, the corporate side of that and how that affected them. But Adams continues that, you know, Carmine had impressed Kinney by having him do Deadman. And then bringing Dick over from Charlton. Those were 2 of Carmine's early coups. Nick Cootie says, you picked up Deadman from Carmine and didn't change a thing. Not the costume, not the storyline, not anything. Would you change anything today if you had the opportunity to do the series over? It was such an interesting concept, says Adams. I suspect Carmine was doing it as a lark. When people talk about the old days, they speak as if they knew that what they did then would have some importance later. But the truth is, when you do something new, you think that probably nothing will become of it. Carmine just threw his imagination into the character, and what came out of it was something that was followable, made a lot of sense, and was almost pure inspiration. If he'd thought about it more, Dead Man might have been less of a character. Which, you know, I don't know if this is a spoiler, and, you know, I think it's okay to say, because he said it to us in a public forum, but now might be the point to say, you know, Neil Adams, you know, fondness for this character. Melanie and I mentioned that, you know, a couple weeks ago we went to a comic convention, you know, even in the show we said, you know, we got the sketch by Neil Adams. While he was doing that sketch, it's so, so awesome, by the way, he called me and Melanie over, you know, to stand next to him. And basically we had like a half hour long chat with him, you know, about his past projects. Like he was hugely proud of Batman Odyssey, and in fact did a little bit of a sales pitch to me and Melanie flipping through the pages or whatever. He's like, and this, if this is gonna drop your blood temperature 3 degrees when you see how chilling this is, like, dude knows how to sell a book. But but one of the really, really, really interesting things, and you know, it's a TPOR exclusive, is Neil Adams told us that he is currently, as in present day, working on a follow-up to his original, you know, Bronze Age run on Dead Man. Like, mind blown. He said that Dan DiDio, you know, has him working on, I guess, on did he say 6 issues, did he say?
I thought he said three.
Three? Okay, well, three in any books? Yeah, in any case, kind of like a mini-series or whatever, you know, picking up the story, you know, as it leaves off, you know, when, as you'll see at the end of our show or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then a couple little tidbits, spoiler alert, he said that it turns out that Boston and Cleveland Brand have another brother and a sister, and that they come from, like, a circus family, you know, and that's going to be kind of a plot point in this. I'm so excited. I can't wait. I just want this to happen. So on that point, actually, going back to this interview or whatever, Nick Cudi asks about that. He says, Dead Man, or Boston Brand, had a twin brother called Cleveland. Who invented Cleveland? And Adams says, I did. And Nick Cudi says, is there going to be a Des Moines Brand? Usually people are named after places where they're born. So how is it possible for one twin to be born in Boston and the other in Cleveland? And Adams replies, well, their parents were circus acrobats. And Giordano speculates, he's like, well, they must have been born on a train between Boston and Cleveland, if there is such a train. But then Cudi says, anyway, it was a good device, he thought, because it allowed the ghostly Dead Man to become flesh and blood, you know, in a way. And Adams says, working on those things can often be the most fun of a creation like Dead Man. You got to remember that Arnold Drake, you know, when he created this, was writing Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis comics at the time. So he had more of a sense of humor than your standard comic book writer. Which brings me, says Cudi, to an interesting point. Drake only wrote the first issue of Dead Man, his creation. Isn't that unusual? And Adam's like, well, I don't think it was unusual at that time. As I mentioned before, Dead Man was kind of conceived as a throwaway, you know, a gag. And it came to everybody's surprise that people were taking it seriously. As, you know, Giordano wraps up saying, the comic book industry was a lot different then than it is now. Artists and writers were interchangeable parts. There's no guarantee that the writer who wrote, say, Superman today will get that assignment the next issue. I tried to bring continuity to DC when I arrived. And in fact, Aquaman, as we mentioned before, by Skeet Sinaparo, was one of the few titles where I was actually successful in keeping the same team on the book from the day I got there to the day I left. And Cudi's like, well, this is definitely an enlightening insight into the early days. As quite honestly, all of the interviews in this book, you know, really are. I really, this is actually one of my prized possessions too, the Dead Man collection.
Sweet.
So should have Adams and he'll autograph this.
Oh, that would have been good.
Yeah. So, but enough about lost opportunities. Let's, you know, make up for it now, you know, with the opportunity we have in front of us, you know, basically the opportunity for you to tell me what you thought about this story.
It was good. I liked it. It got Dead Man out and about. You know, he wasn't in a circus kind of environment.
Yeah. I like those better, to be honest. Like, you know, the circus thing is cool. Obviously, that's the, you know, his origin or whatever. But yeah, but too much of that trapeze thing, I'm just not really, I kind of like the more, like, hard-boiled, noir-y type stuff.
And also, we get to know who he is.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, see him interact, you know, with you know, different, what we had, like, you know, doctors and, you know, spiritualists or whatever. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, what'd you think about that whole aspect of it?
Yeah, so I kind of suspected that she wasn't really on the up and up, but I couldn't really tell, like, until she actually pulled the gun.
Yeah, but no, I think what I was actually asking, though, is, you know, obviously this is the 1960s or whatever, like, you know, new age and spiritualism and stuff, you know, all coming to the forefront. But did you think, you know, maybe it was filtered a little bit, you know, through the eyes of, like, you know, stodgy men or whatever? They're like, oh, this is all fake.
That I did notice there were only like 2 points where like psychedelia came into it.
Yeah.
Like the initial one was actually in the lettering, you know, like for the title where it says that, you know, the call from beyond.
Oh yeah, Ben Oda doing that kind of like swirly type stuff.
Yeah, and then later on the son's name Sammy.
Yeah.
When he was like commenting that, you know, like this, like about the freak out.
No. That was actually, that was Deadman when he was possessing him, said, is this some kind of freak out?
Oh.
Because was like, yeah, Deadman's like a hip old dude. Because actually, no, think about it. He actually, long, long time ago, right, in I think the third Deadman story, the club he went to was a club freak out.
So, oh, that's right.
So, but you dug the story, though, overall?
Yeah, I would say so.
What about the artwork, you know, like I'd said, you know, in that little interview we just looked at, you know, obviously Neil Adams, you know, pushing the boundaries. How'd you feel about that initial black and white sequence thing, that, you know, sort of inside Tiny's brain?
Yeah, so that's kind of crazy. Really expressive kind of stuff, inventive as well. And also, I like how, like, the artwork really showed how Deadman actually has, like, this new power where, like, he can like release people from like whatever that netherworld thing is, or
all the little like, yeah, like brain monsters or whatever.
Yeah. You know, like, or synapses.
Yeah.
So
I actually, quite honestly, not to, you know, usurp your, I thought it was kind of neat that, you know, the way in which Deadman even became aware of this was kind of like almost a subliminal suggestion by Vashnu.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's...
Well, he's a sneaky little guy, isn't he?
Yeah, well, I think we're going to see as, like, the story continues, yeah, he's a lot more sneaky than, you know, than we realize.
Yeah, and that wasn't really subliminal either.
Right. What else? Anything else about the story, or...?
No, not so much. I mean, like, it flowed really well, so, I mean, I would have to say, like, Giordano as, like, a new editor, like, you know, really, he had commented in the thing that you read in the beginning before we got into the story,
mm-hmm,
that, you know, he received no interference and he was left to his own devices to learn his craft.
Yeah.
And I would say that he totally did it. It was engaging and it kept moving at a good pace. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't too fast in one spot and too slow in another. It was even.
Yeah. I mean, when we, going back a couple of weeks when we, you know, met Neil Adams or whatever, he definitely, you know, spoke of Dick Giordano in glowing terms. You know, I think, mm-hmm, as Dick was saying in that interview, you know, the two of them as two kind of, yeah, young presences, you know, within DC, you know, I guess kind of found allies, you know, within each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, friendship is only going to grow. You know, I alluded to a little bit early on the idea that he and Adams are going to go off and form their own studio. We're probably not going to talk about that probably until, like, you know, the next volume of our show or whatever.
Mm.
But Continuity Associates is going to be a big New York-based studio where a lot of, like, up-and-coming artists and writers, you know, pass through. And all to the, you know, to the credit of Giordano and Adams. So, yeah, just a 1-2 punch team. Like, I honestly, I'm hard pressed to have, like, much more discussion. It was a, you know, a one and done story, you know, kind of, mm-hmm, like a little 17 pager. It advanced the narrative a little bit, I guess. You know, we get Tiny, you know, revitalized, but kind of almost a little bit of filler, I guess, with that second half.
Yeah, probably. Although it was interesting, like, how she thought about spirits, you know, because, like, it wasn't really, like, her anyway, you know, Pegan. It was, like, what the artist thought of, like, what they thought that she would have...
That they would look like?
Made the spirit. Yeah, and they looked like large insects.
That's funny. All right. So do you want to, I guess, like I say, I can't think of anything. Do you want to just cast your judgment? Was this one live, die, you know, hang out somewhere in a coma-like nether state? Or...
No, he's definitely going to live.
Yeah. So... All right. Anything else on any of the, you know, personages? You know, any questions about Neil Adams, Dick Giordano before we start wrapping up?
Or... Yeah, I have one. Just one little thing that stuck out at me. Because when you were reading the article beforehand,
mm-hmm,
you'd mentioned that DC used to distribute Marvel?
Yeah, no, that honestly, that took me by surprise. I don't really... Honestly, I don't know much about comics distribution. Like, you know, in the modern era... I know there's a company called Diamond, but There, you know, and matter of fact, Neil Adams was telling us about old distribution things too. But I don't want to get into that in this episode.
No.
We're going to cover that, I think, you know, at the end of the arc. But yeah, I have no idea how they distributed Marvel. I'll look into that, or if anybody out there knows, you know, by all means, you know, feel free to let us know. But you know, feel free to communicate us with us. You know, as we're always like begging for letters or whatever. Which, by the way, yeah, you know what? Oh, thank you for that. I'll use that as a segue. We did get a little bit of feedback or whatever, in probably one of the most unlikely avenues or whatever. You know, Facebook, hardly anything ever happens out there.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have one listener, a guy by the name of Bradley Austin Null. You know, one of our Facebook followers gave us a little shout out, saying that our episode 48, you know, the second half of the Legion thing, he thought it was a great episode, and he told us that. You know, ours is rapidly becoming one of his favorite podcasts. He always looks forward to listening. So so thank you, Bradley. You know, tell your friends, you know.
You are a man of taste and class.
Exactly. So, all right. I guess that that wraps it up. Before we, you know, conclude, I do want to loop back around. It's been a while since I've given, like, music credit.
Mm.
And, you know, with these shorter Dead Man episodes, that kind of afford me a little bit extra time. So let me take this opportunity to go back, as the last one we did was a Dead Man one for 43. So picking up on episode 44, the Johnny Peril story, because of, you know, how his stories are so, you know, believe them or not, he's just telling them to you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I sandwiched that between two songs about lying. First we had Liar Liar by the Castaways, and then wrapping it up with the song Lies by the Beatles sound alike band, the Knickerbockers, kind of an American band that sounds like, honestly, sounds amazingly like John Lennon. Let's see, 45 was Stan Lee's Monster. We went back a little bit to the 1950s for I Was a Teenage Monster by the Keytones. Let's see, episode 46, The Hawk and the Dove, amazing Vietnam era song called 2 + 2 = you know, question mark, I guess, 2 + 2 = what, by, believe it or not, Bob Seger.
Mm-hmm.
But before he was part of Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, it was his original Detroit-based band called the Bob Seger System. And inspiration, by the way, for the White Stripes, Jack White often cites that as one of his favorite songs. And I don't know if you noticed, but I think at least the bass line from that was almost a direct, you know, inspiration for Seven Nation Army.
Oh, neat. I hadn't realized that.
Yeah, yeah. Like I say, it could just be me, but I mean, it definitely sounded very, very similar. Let's see. 47 is actually a song I know you despise, but I think it's awesome.
It was fitting.
Yeah. It's Time Has Come Today, or Time Has Come Today, I should say, by the Chambers Brothers. That the song, like, it's so 1960s.
Yeah,
my dad used to be a big fan of it. And when I was a kid in the 1980s, there was this really, really like B-grade horror film called Bad Dreams that uses it or whatever to really good effect. But like I say, you know, I've always been a fan of this song, but I know you and I are on completely opposite, you know, sides of the fence on that.
I like about 30 seconds of it.
Let's see what else. Last episode, you know, the conclusion of the Legion stuff. We did Children of the Future, really obscure song by a Steve Miller Band, like, you know, super early psychedelic stuff. And then for Dead Man, again, episode 49, we've looped back around to the Maduro music, and this time out using Blindfold Ballet.
Yay.
Which, yeah, very good. I think it's almost like an otherworldly thing. I kind of, almost like a heartbeat. I thought it was good for the Tiny in a Coma thing.
Yeah.
So, all right. So that wraps up, you know, this episode. Like I say, next time out, we are going to be at episode 50, you know, our big, you know.
The big 5-0.
Yeah, our golden anniversary here, which ironically, we are not doing golden age stuff, but we are going to do something that, you know, is very, very, you know, rarely covered on our show. You know, I'll put that out there or whatever, and, you know, maybe people can figure out, you know, what era we're tackling. But I will say we are covering no fewer than 4 stories in our next episode.
I thought you were going to say 50.
No, 4 stories. And the characters are a character that we haven't seen in a really long time, since very near the beginning of our show. B, a character that we've seen recently but don't like. C, a character that has made a couple little appearances on our show, but mostly as, like, you know, footnotes. I have done a voice for him, but we haven't actually covered a story, so the first full story for him. And then D, a character that we have never met. So, you know, across the spectrum, it's going to be a neat little spotlight on, you know, some things, you know. So
I think I know who B is.
You know who B is?
And I think I know what's coming for D.
For D. Okay. Well, cool. I hope folks out there can figure it out. And what's more is that I hope, you know, people tune in next time to discover that. So with that in mind, you know, let us tell people, you know, where they can tune in. To begin with, you know, all of these episodes, you know, 49 and, you know, soon to be 50 can be found at our website, which is
tporpodcast.com.
Right. And if you like any of those or don't like them, you know, which I don't know if you've listened to 49 of them, you're not liking them. But but if, you know, whatever your opinion, you can write to us and let us know how you feel at our email address, which is
tporpodcast@gmail.com.
That's right. You can follow us in a couple venues. You know, you can follow us on Twitter, which is
@tporpodcast.
Or Facebook.
Facebook.com/tporpodcast.
Right, you can do as, you know, Bradley Austin Null does, and, you know, leave us some comments out there, or, you know, and if you, you know, want to join in that conversation, make sure you join that group. Other things you can join is a subscription service. You know, we have many of those where you can download our episodes weekly. You can do so on
iTunes.
That's right. Or Google Play or
Stitcher Radio
or Podcastpedia, or, as always,
any podcatcher of your choice.
Of your choice, exactly. So with that in mind, as always, we want to thank everyone for joining us. We hope you had a good time, and we hope to see you here next time on our 50th anniversary episode of the Parliament of Rooks podcast.
Thanks, everybody.